What's going on? Welcome back to the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I have an amazing episode for you today with my coach, Alex Viata. He's an incredible science-based coach. He's helped my training tremendously. He's improved my resting heart rate down to 40 beats per minute. And we talk about a lot in this episode. We talk about philosophy, we talk about cardio, we talk about strength training, we talk about things we love in the industry, things we hate in the industry. This is just an all-around, all-encompassing call. And at the very end, we actually do my coaching call. So every now and then, Alex and I will hop on a call and we analyze my training. And so we actually did that on this call at the end of the episode. So I think you're going to like it a lot. I hope you do. Please, if you do, please leave a five-star review on iTunes or Spotify. They really do help a lot. And with that being said, let's get into the episode. And boom, Alex Viata, we're live, brother. How's it going?
Man, it is going well. It is going well. This has been, again, like long overdue. I feel like I say that every time we chat.
I know. I love speaking with you. For everyone who doesn't know, Alex is, aside from a great friend and incredible colleague who I've learned a tremendous amount from, Alex is also my coach right now. You've been my coach, I think, over a year now. I think just about a year ago, we started working together. And it's like I've just continued to learn a tremendous amount from you. My athletic performance has improved. My health has improved. It's been really great working with you. And we've done two podcasts already. The first one was very zone two focused. The second one was zone two and then some other things as well. But both of those have gotten a great response. So if you haven't listened to those yet, I'll put the links in the show notes if you want to go listen to those. But otherwise, Alex, how are you, man? How's your holiday season? How is everything?
Holiday season was good. Holiday season was busy. Like we were just chatting a little bit before we logged on here, just dealing with farm animals. Like, that's not even a joke.
You delivered baby goats.
Delivered
baby goats.
Yeah. It's really funny because thinking back to, 12, 13 years ago when I was working corporate and, consulting and wearing a suit and tie to work, thinking that I would be out there sitting in a barn at, 3 in the morning, covered with baby goats going, okay, this is going to be my new life. And you know what? I couldn't be happier about it. But so
dude, how did you get into, like, were you brought up on with farm animals? Like, How did you get involved? Like, going from corporate life, wearing a suit, all this, and then being a fitness coach, super high level fitness coach, by the way. And then you're also, you have your own business, Complete Human Performance, but you also have farm, you have geese, you have goats, you do stuff with wolves. Like, how the fuck did this happen?
Honestly, it's all been just, it's one thing to just have always like loved animals. And I remember when I was growing up, my mom was a huge influence. We always rode horses. She had when we lived overseas, we as little kids, my mom was just always getting us out doing things. So, there was horses, animals, always part of it. And honestly, it wasn't even until a couple of years ago when I got this property that had all this land on it, and I said, I got to do something with it. And, just the idea of, for me, there's something, part of the reason why I switched out of corporate was to basically get to a lifestyle that I found, obviously, I was more passionate about, I really enjoyed, but also started getting very, very protective about incorporating, not just relaxing and doing nothing, but relaxing by doing things that actually I feel center me and ground me in a way. And animals to me, just taking care of something that has absolute reliance, but challenges you in a different way. Every animal has its own motivations, its own personality. You have to get out of your headspace and think as the animal does and be receptive to where they're at. And it's such a good centering exercise. So having them is natural for me at this point. It's great. It's great having all these different, types of creatures that force you to think differently and think different ways about, about what are their motivations, what keeps them happy. It's been a great exercise. And I think just on top of that, it's a lot of fun watching them grow and, having chickens with their own eggs and, learning their different personalities and all that. It's really gratifying. It's hard work, but it's really gratifying.
I have so many questions, two of which I'm definitely going to ask with early in this conversation. The first question that I have is, how do you balance, your training, which is, you train very, very hard. You're a very high level athlete. In addition to running a business and you have your own coaches and you have clients, me being one of them, who you're unbelievably responsive with, in addition to running a fucking farm. Like with like you've got horses and geese and goats and you do stuff with wool. Like, how do you balance all of this at the same? How do you do it all?
You know, honestly, man, I got to tell you, it's taken a long, long time. It's taken a long, long time because I think for so many people, you know, all of our brains work differently. We all have different ways of organizing our time. We all have different ways of organizing our space. I probably tried so many different types of, you know, activity trackers and schedules and journals and things like that until I finally found a system that actually lets me, the more routine I have, I think, the more I can automate some things in my life. You know, I having the same thing for breakfast every day, having an alarm at the same time every day that, you know, reminds me to, you know, go up and take care of different tasks. Like my Tuesday every week kind of looks the same. Even though I've got a lot of things to do, my Tuesday generally looks the same. And I set alarms for various things and I put various things on my calendar. So putting the entire week into as much of a routine as possible, it frees up so much more mental bandwidth for doing everything else. And, you know, I think that's really helped because I have, you know, I'm always ruthless with my Sundays, are days when I literally just sit down and program for everybody. And I get myself in that headspace. I shut everything else off and I tell myself, okay, I have this one major responsibility today that I can put everything towards and I'm not going to pay attention to anything else. And yes, you know, there may be other things I need doing, but I know if I start dividing my attention that way, I know for me, I just become less efficient at everything. So a lot of my life lately has been trying to be very, very ruthless with being single-minded, single-focused on a task at any given point, whether it's a given day of the week, a given hour in the day, anything else. So like, you know, for example, Mondays between 3 and 5 o'clock, I have a very set time set aside to do work outside, to take care of certain things. So a lot of it really just comes down to that. It's finding like a life management system that works for you. And even if other people don't understand it, you know, because I spent a lot of time like listening to, you know, different life coaches and business coaches. Here's how you got to put this stuff together. And here's how you got to work. And none of it worked for me. And I think it took a long time to just find that, okay, here's my system that works. It works for me. And I'm just going to really dig into this. And that's, I think that's really let me divide my life into a lot of different kind of buckets. And still stay on top of all of them. And that's, I mean, that's really all I can say is just the huge benefit of if something can be made routine, make it routine. You know, it is so phenomenal what that does. And it's even proven psychologically, like the more routines you have, the more available bandwidth you have for everything else, even if it's creative stuff or family or work or anything else, routine.
That makes total sense. Now, I'm going to ask a different question that I was planning. I'll go back to the other one. This might be an uncomfortable question, but I think it's an important question, especially for people listening. When I look at you, I see an unbelievably successful person, not just with business, but with life. You just seem like you're happy. You seem like you've accomplished so much. You seem like you're living the life that you want to live, which is wonderful. Mm. Have you had any major failures in your life in the last couple of years or any time? But like, is there anything that you've failed with?
Absolutely. Yeah. And honestly, I've had long-term relationships that didn't work out. I've had entire career paths that didn't work out. Before I got into coaching, I thought I was, you know, I thought I knew what I wanted to do. And I realized part of my issue was in corporate and consulting. I held down jobs, but I was never as successful in them as I wanted to be. And I knew my heart wasn't in it and my mind wasn't in it. And I knew I was never going to be able to get to where I felt I deserved to get to because I know I didn't have the discipline or the passion and anything else to get to where I wanted to get. So in many respects, my corporate career, granted, I got out of it being marginally successful, but that failed to be a career for the rest of my life. That's not where I wanted to be. I've had relationships that have failed that haven't worked out. You know, major ones. I'm divorced at this point. There have been a lot of things in life where I think I devoted a lot of time to them and a lot of effort, and they haven't worked out at all the way I intended. I think, honestly, the biggest thing in the last couple of years that's made me feel like I could be more successful is not having that whole sunk cost viewpoint and being able to say, hey, you know what? I did fail at this. It's time to move on. I think trying to turn what is already a, I don't want to say a sinking ship because that sounds so negative, but looking at something that you're clearly not succeeding at and throwing yourself into it twice as much when you're not sure it's something that serves you is such a trap to fall into. And I think most of my successes in life have been saying, hey, you know what? This isn't working out for me. I'm going to let this go. I'm not going to spend twice as much effort into making something work that I'm not even sure serves me when I can turn around and devote myself wholeheartedly to something that does. And I think being able to say no and being able to say I quit to a lot of things, there's always value to dedication. You know, there's always value to saying, hey, this is something I really want. I need to work hard at it. But make sure that what you're working hard at is something you truly want. And I think asking myself that question multiple times over the years is let me come to terms with failure, I think, is the biggest thing. Because then you feel like, okay, you know what? I didn't succeed, but that's not me. I'm not throwing all these resources into something that's failing. I'm admitting, hey, I took a loss here. Let me go find something to succeed at.
I like that a lot. I like that viewpoint. It reminds me of Seth Godin's, what's his book? The Dip. Have you read The Dip by Seth Godin?
Yeah.
I think I read it in like 45 minutes. It's a very quick book, but it challenges the whole concept of, you know, quitters never win and winners never quit, where it's basically like, no, it's not true. Like the people who win the most are actually the best quitters because don't let a failing endeavor continue longer than it has to. They see, hey, this is not worth it for me. I'm failing at it. This isn't something that I really want anymore. I'm done, rather than just trying to grit their teeth and fight their way through something that they don't want anyway. Now, the hard part is, I think, figuring out which things do you actually want and which things are you just like, are you just trying to get out of because it's difficult, right? Like that, I think, that's the challenging one to really get a better understanding. I don't know if you have any advice on that front. How do you figure out if it's worth it to you or not?
Yeah. And that is always a really, really good question. And I think, you know, part of that was, you know, I think part of that was even early on, you know, again, when I finally threw myself into my corporate career and got the job I thought I wanted and hated it. And realized, you know, that maybe there was something here. Maybe I should have seen this coming, that this wasn't something I wanted. You know, it's difficult to have an honest conversation with yourself when you're struggling with something. I think any time that you've hit a wall in something, you're stuck there. You're stuck in the dip. You're stuck in the trough. And you're thinking, the only way I can go right now, I need to climb up this in order to succeed. How do I know if I quit right now? How do I know if I'm not climbing up this because I'm in a trough and because it would take work or because this isn't what I want in the first place? And that's why I usually tell people, like with every single endeavor, don't quit. Basically, ask yourself the question if it's something you want while you're succeeding at it. Ask yourself what you're getting out of it. It's like when things are going smoothly, you know, when you had a success at work, think, is this enough to make me want to do the next one? If you're training for some event, or if you've lost 5 pounds or whatever your goal is, as you're engaging in it, think, okay, am I just happy because I'm succeeding at something, or am I happy because this is what I want? And I think the other question, and I think this is the big one for me, is if you're facing a challenge, if you're facing something you're failing at, and you think, what would it take for me to succeed? The answer to that question, what would it take for me to succeed? Look at what it would take and think, are these things that will universally make me better? In other words, if I develop this skill set, or if I work on this skill set, whatever I need to let me succeed at this task or this goal, are those things that I really want to develop for myself? Do I think I need to develop them myself? If it's something like, hey, to succeed at this, I'm going to need to, you know, learn this programming language, or, you know, something, you know, whatever else, or I'm going to need to, you know, spend less time with my family. Think, is that something I really want to develop in myself? Because if it's saying, hey, look, I'm just going to have to get up a little earlier. I'm going to have to adjust my sleep schedule. I'm going to have to work a little bit harder. I'm going to have to get outside my comfort zone a little bit. Okay, great. You know, those are things that if you get good at them, you think I can use that anywhere in life. Mm-hmm. You know, these are universal skills. These are things I'm going to develop, things that are of value to me. But if they're not things that are of value to you that you're going to need to succeed at this, it's probably not worth it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I like that viewpoint of it. As you were talking, I was thinking about what have I done? And I was trying to objectively analyze sort of my thought process on things. And I think one thing that I often do when I'm faced with a difficult choice, like should I quit, should I not quit, something like that, is this is not conscious, but something I've done that I noticed, like my pattern, is I realize no matter which I choose, I'm going to be okay either way, right? Like just automatic, because I think a lot of people, when they have these choices, these hard choices, it's like a do or die mentality. And they're so worried that if they choose the quote unquote wrong one, then everything else is going to be like an avalanche and it's going to be terrible. And the reality is it's just the first choice of many more choices down the road. And mm-hmm. with each choice, you have another opportunity to win. And there's always positives that you can take from it. And so I think so many people get so caught up in trying to make the right choice that they don't make any choice. And by not making any choice, they actually do make a choice, right? Yeah. It sounds very stupid, yeah. but like they essentially stay with what they're doing, even though they don't like it, they half-ass it. And then like yep. they don't get to where they want to be. And then 10 years goes by and they haven't really made any progress because of a lack of choice that essentially was a choice. Whereas yep. if you just make a decision one way or another, you will be better off than just staying in that middle.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Because you need to push yourself to develop something. When you make yeah. a decision, that's a proactive thing. And not making a decision, sometimes staying with something, knowing you're not going to address whatever it is that's the source of your discontent with it, you are effectively, like you said, making the decision to keep doing this and keep spending your time and bandwidth on something that isn't for you.
Yeah, that makes total sense. All right, now I'm going to go back to a question that I wanted to ask several minutes ago, which is going to be completely off topic at this point, but I am very interested. So you love animals. You love animals. I've learned that about you, and it's been really cool to learn a little bit about what you do with animals. You are not vegan or vegetarian, correct?
Correct.
So can you talk about that? Like, you love animals. You also eat animals. Can you talk about this lifestyle? Because I feel like a lot of people who might not be as knowledgeable about either conservation or animal welfare or any of that, they might not know how someone can balance the love for animals while also still eating them. Can you talk about your choices and what has led you to this decision?
Sure. Yeah. And I think part of that is, first of all, like I haven't done this for many years, but I do hunt. I have raised animals for food. I think, first of all, having a greater respect for what goes into it and realizing that you can love and care for something and it has a fixed horizon of life.
Mm.
That is, I think in a lot of ways, that breeds a compassion for the moment that's not based on fear of loss.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to love something and care for something on the understanding that there is loss, there is an end date, is, I think, it actually creates almost more incentive to ensure a good lifestyle and ensure opportunity and ensure it's happy. And I think that's why I think a lot of issues with like large-scale factory farming is unconscionable. Because I think with that understanding, with that caring for animals, comes a responsibility to make it as painless as possible and to make the animal's life as good as possible before the moment of its ending, realizing that, I mean, you know, death is an inevitability for everything, for every animal. And I think as stewards, and I really do see humans as stewards of the environment at this point, it's imperative that we do everything to ensure the best quality of life in that interim. So I think, you know, that's a big part of it. I think there's a lot of caring that goes on, but then you say, well, okay, you know, how do you reconcile that with the fact that at the end of the day, animals are dying and, you know, factory farming, I think part of that is pragmatism. I think it's, look, if we could come up with plant-based nutrients that would require no loss of animal life, and most importantly, would ensure affordable, adequate sources of nutrition for the entire globe with no unforeseen side effects, I would say, yeah, absolutely. Like, let's go for it. No question. I think, unfortunately, you know, I kind of on a global level, if I went vegan, would that necessarily make a difference? Probably not. Mm-hmm. You know, I personally take steps to ensure that, you know, I'm ethically sourcing as much meat as possible. And I think on a global level, I think we have a lot of work to do before we get to the point where the entire population of the world can be provided. So I think from an ethical level, is it my responsibility to take some, you know, if I believe that eventually the world should go vegan because I love animals, you know, should I be doing more to help out? Possibly. I don't know. For me, it's a case of where, you know, I believe that organisms on this earth, like, we do operate in a food web. We do operate in, you know, this kind of virtuous circle. I think it's imperative that we all maintain our position in it. You know, we give back to the environment as much as possible. We give back to conservation. We support ethical sources of farming, of meat, of everything else. And also realizing and balancing that against the purely selfish side of things that says, well, it is a, you know, animal meat is an incredibly good source of nutrition mm-hmm. for us. And I have concerns about the path that a lot of, you know, vegan, I would say, companies and substitutes and all that are actually going in their own right.
Mm.
You know, there's certainly, yes, there are a lot of them with, you know, very positive intentions, but I'm always skeptical about a lot of new industries and a lot of new companies. They are prone to just as much, you know, just as many ethical breaches as mm. anything else. And I think that's really it. And I know that sounds like a non-answer. It's like, well, how have I addressed the fact that I'm still eating animals, even though I love them? The two aren't irreconcilable.
Yeah. That makes sense. You know, for me, I've only been hunting once. I'm looking forward to going again. When I killed the deer that I actually still have the meat from, and we're still, you know, feeding my family with it, yeah. Dude, I cried. Like I cried. I said a prayer. Like it was,
yeah.
I've never gone to a steakhouse and cried when I was given the steak that like in front of me, but like that was equally an animal. And yeah. But ever since I went hunting that first time, it's made me so much more aware of the food that I'm eating and so much more aware of where the meat is coming from. And also just thinking about the life that the deer had that I hunted and killed, it had a much better life than a lot of the animals that are factory farmed, right? I mean, it was out in the nature, in wild, on its own, living a great life up until the moment its life was taken, whereas factory farming, you know, it's not a good life. That they, it's suffering, it's torture, it's not good. So it's one of the reasons that I was actually very happily surprised when I made it public that I was going hunting. The people who were most supportive were vegans. Yeah. They were, aside from the hunting community loved it, but the vegan community loved that I was going hunting. They were like, we wish all meat eaters did this. It's the most sustainable. It's the most ethical. It gives an entire completely, it gives a very, a much more appreciation for what you're eating. And it gives a greater life to what you're eating. And it's also, especially for hunting, I didn't realize this, how much, in order to actually hunt, so much of the ability to hunt and paying for your hunting license, all this stuff, all that money goes right back into conservation, to protecting the land, helping the animals live better lives. Like I had no idea of any of this. So that was a really a tremendous experience for me.
And I think that's what a lot of it comes down to, is this idea that I think there's this thought that somehow killing an animal is inherently immoral or inherent. We're not going to get away from that as living organisms that are part of an entire network of interrelated organisms. We're not going to get away from that. And by nature of our existence as what we are, there's always going to be, until we get to a point again, where we can synthetically produce all our needs, in which case, great, we will be completely transcendent in that point. But I think until we get there, you know, like when you do, when you hunt, when you raise your own livestock, everything else, you get to the point where you have such an appreciative relationship with them, and you see that actually caring for them is, it becomes such a part of your character and becomes such a part of your worldview that it's not a contradiction anymore.
Mm.
It's not just blithely walking in and seeing a cow as a, you know, red piece of meat that comes in a shrink wrapped container. Like that's not it anymore. And so, you know, it's as much as you have that appreciation, the opposite of loving animals is not eating animals. The opposite of loving animals is treating animals just like a product. And I think that's the difference right there.
That's a line right there. That's right there. That's a fucking mic drop moment if I've ever heard one. That's genius. And I love that. And I couldn't agree more. All right. Let's get into the topic that you and I initially wanted to discuss, I think like a month plus ago. Actually, before we do, I just want to say I appreciate these types of hard conversations that you and I like just had, like these difficult I love these more philosophical conversations. Yeah. I think these types of conversations are somewhat of a rarity nowadays in general, never mind on a recorded call. And I just appreciate your openness and willingness to discuss this stuff. I think it's I don't know. I miss these types of conversations. So I like having them in my life. And it's one of the reasons I appreciate you. So we're not going to, you know, let's name him. We're going to name him because I actually really like him. I really like this guy. I think he's overall a tremendous, tremendous content creator. And I like 99.999% of the things that I've seen him say. There was one thing that Peter Attia made content about that I was like, man, that's really disappointing. Basically, so Peter Attia, overall, again, love this guy. Have learned a lot from him. Big fan of him. But he made a piece of content within the last couple of months talking about how the elliptical is a terrible piece of equipment to use for your cardio. And there were a whole bunch of things that he said that didn't make any sense. I want to give you the floor to talk about, to sort of address what he said, and then also talk about why I know you disagree with it. So why you disagree with it and what you actually think about the elliptical.
Sure. Okay. So, you know, I think first things first is, you know, again, I appreciate evaluating the statement and not an individual's entire body of work. I said, I mean, a lot of the work he does is absolutely fantastic, and I'm sure he has his reasons for stating it. So, you know, confronted with that, the first thing I want to do is kind of, you know, steel man his argument, which would be, okay, why could I conceivably agree with this? So my thoughts on why I could conceivably agree with this. Ellipticals, by their very construction, have they have size, proportion, everything else. They have a fixed relative plane of motion. Sometimes you can find an elliptical, like any other piece of equipment, that may not be sized appropriately for you. The steps may be too short. Your feet may be too far apart. You know, one of the things people, I think, need to do more is not just jump on a piece of equipment, but make sure that piece of equipment is right for them. So many gyms will have more than one kind of elliptical. And you may say, yeah, I like this one a little better than that one. Yeah, but, you know, either one is fine. No, like, find the one that you like better. Find what works for you. Because, you know, like anything else, if you're doing this motion over and over again and the size and proportions are just wrong for you, you're probably going to end up with some issues. So I could see almost from a clinical perspective, again, you would say, hey, look, a lot of people come in and they overdo it on the elliptical and they have all these strains and everything else. However, I will also say that this is probably also self-selecting. A lot of people use the elliptical as one of their first introductions to cardiovascular training. So he may be dealing in that regard with people who don't have a lot of experience doing a lot of work. So the elliptical is the first place they're doing it. It's the first place they're going to see a strain. So, you know, I think that's where a lot of it comes
from. That's a good point. That's a very good point.
Because honestly, I think the elliptical is a great piece of equipment. If it was the only thing you were doing, if you were 100% sedentary all day and all you did was the elliptical, I would say you may want to incorporate some kind of cardiovascular training that has you on your own two feet taking some impact occasionally. Because a little bit of impact, like anything else, is good. It's good for you. It's good for your bones. It forces, you know, there's certain kinds of strain that the sudden impact of hitting the ground, even just taking a step, puts on your bones that causes more bone formation. It causes more strength. So if you only exclusively do something that's not weight bearing, again, not great. But that's not the case for most of us. Most of us, even if we're sedentary, get a couple thousand steps a day. That's enough to get some adaptations there. I think the elliptical is a great piece of equipment. It uses pretty much every muscle in the body. it absolutely is a massive, it can be very taxing to your cardiovascular system and not cause local muscular failure, which is a big issue for people. Some people get on the exercise bike and their legs burn out long before they get their heart rate up where they want it to be. Same thing with running. Orthopedic issues may be uncomfortable and stop you from getting in the work you need to get in before something takes you out. So I think overall, I agree that there are some downsides to it, but I think the versatility, the low impact nature of the equipment, the lack of eccentric strain, all of these things put together make the elliptical one of those machines that can give you an outstanding cardiovascular workout, especially low intensity, elicit all the adaptations you want, and do so in such a way that it is the incident per hour on it, all else being equal, of injury is extremely low.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's one of those things where there are pros and cons to literally everything. In life, never mind in fitness, but we could look at any piece of any exercise, any piece of equipment, anything. There are always there are some dangers and there are some advantages. We essentially have to look at the ratio of that. Yeah. Like, all right, like the ratio of dangers to advantages. When I look at the elliptical, bro, like I don't know anybody who's gotten hurt on the elliptical. Ever. Like, I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but like the only way that I could see someone really getting hurt is if they fucking fall off. Like that's like, yeah. I've seen, you know, it's a lie. I remember I used to coach a woman and her child would come to every workout. And one time he was like essentially using an elliptical, like a jungle gym, and he fell off and like he got hurt, but it wasn't from using the elliptical. It was like a 4-year-old kid who fell off while his mom was working out. I know a lot of people, myself included, who've gotten injuries from running, and like, but I still think running is a great exercise. It's just you have to build up the tolerance to do it appropriately, and to, you know, so whether it's shin splints or whatever it is. Like, I think the elliptical is one of the best pieces of equipment for anybody, but especially for a starter piece of equipment for people who might be very, very heavy, looking for more cardiovascular improvements for their health, for zone two work. I mean, I remember one time I went to New York with my wife for a wedding, and they didn't have the assault bike that you and I were working on. So I did my high intensity work on the elliptical, and it was equally as great. Like, totally fine. I would prefer to do it on the assault bike. I just think it would be a little bit more comfortable, but my heart rate got to the right zone. I was able to sustain it the whole time. I felt a little bit awkward, you know, doing that, like that movement, but you know, it is what it is. Like, it worked great. So one of the issues that I had with his post on this, and I think this is really important. One of my goals as a content creator and coach is to try and help people become better critical thinkers. I think learning critical thinking is just woefully, woefully undertaught, under-discussed. It's like, I would way rather we learn critical thinking in school than, I don't know. I don't know the last time I ever used, like I've never looked at it, like, I mean, that's a rhombus or that's a hexagon. Like, but I would rather learn critical thinking. But one of the arguments that he used was a logical fallacy. Basically, he was saying it's not a natural movement. Right. It's not, he said, it's not a natural movement. And this is something that people say when they want to make you believe what they're saying, but they don't actually have a legitimate claim to make. Just because something isn't quote unquote natural does not mean anything about its relevancy or its efficacy would be a better word for there. Like, but he went on to say that cycling is a great form of exercise. And I'm like, how, in what fucking world is cycling a natural movement? Yeah. It's not. So he contradicted himself. And again, I have to say, I really like Peter Attia. For the people, there's a difference between attacking the person versus attacking the argument. Yep. In this instance, what he said didn't make sense. And the reason I'm so passionate about this is because there are many people who the elliptical is like the only piece of equipment that they can comfortably use. And they see something like this from someone who has a big voice, a big audience, and who's super highly educated. And then they're going to think, oh, wow, I shouldn't be using this. And that's really what got me upset about it. But I mean, what do you think about the sort of the naturalistic fallacy?
Well, no, and I absolutely agree. And, you know, as we were thinking about this, I was thinking, well, you know, what if I had said something? Because, you know, we speak off the cuff all the time. And every now and then we try to send out messages, and what we intended to say is not actually what comes out.
Yep.
And someone may call us out on that and say, hey, I disagree with this. You go, well, that's not really what I meant. Here, let me clarify. It's incumbent on us as communicators to ensure that what the average person gets out of our message is really what we intended to say. Mm-hmm. So that's just a way of, you know, quickly defraying, well, maybe that's not quite what he meant. Because at the end of the day, what we're evaluating is what was presented. And part of that was saying this is not a natural movement. And I'm with you. How is cycling any more natural movement? I mean, sitting on a stationary bike is even, you know, no more equivalent to actually road biking than an elliptical is to cross-country skiing, which is effectively what it was originally based on. So as far as saying these aren't natural movements, in fact, you could almost argue that cross-country skiing in some parts of the world is every bit as natural, if not more natural, than cycling. So, you know, I think the problem with that is assuming that every motion we do in the gym and everything we do for exercise needs to be immediately applicable. I mean, a barbell is an absolutely arbitrary piece of equipment. When have you ever encountered a barbell out in the wild? It's just not a thing. I mean, pretty much, right, because pretty much everything we do for exercise is meant to be a reasonable facsimile. It is meant to be approachable. It's meant to solve a lot of problems that we may have just trying to go out in our backyard and pick up rocks. It's going, okay, well, a rock's not going to do, unless you happen to do strongman, a rock's not going to do, like, let's make this into something a bit more convenient. That doesn't mean that lifting a barbell isn't going to help you move stuff in your backyard. It absolutely will. Going on the elliptical is absolutely going to make walking and running easier. It just is. You're improving a lot of the same things. And I think trying to say that something doesn't have immediate carryover, I think, unfortunately, that's something that very experienced strength and conditioning coaches know. But you may have brilliant individuals who are not very experienced strength and conditioning coaches who haven't made that connection yet. Because I think all of us, you know, especially trainers, when we first start training people, we think, okay, well, listen, we need to make these functional movements. And, you know, if I'm working with athletes, I need to make all their training to be as functional as possible to carry over to their sport. And the longer you've been at it, you realize that doesn't matter. You just want to get people strong. You want to get their hearts healthy. You want to get their, you know, their lung capacity. You want to do all those things. Find the best tool to do that. And sometimes the best tool is not what is most like the real world. Sometimes the best tool is what lets people do it. And honestly, I have not known anybody who is absolutely dedicated to doing the elliptical and does it the appropriate intensity who is not also in pretty damn good shape. Like, it just is. And we should be removing barriers to getting people to being healthy and not being arbitrary gatekeepers to movement type to say you have to do this.
Man, you're just dropping the mic all over this podcast. That's dude, well said, man. I completely agree. I completely agree. And one last time, big fan of Peter Attia. I think he's done so much positive. That was literally the one piece of content where I was like, yeah, we have to talk about this. Cause I had so many people send it to me being like, oh my God, like people were worried. Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's like, and I'm like, I'm literally on the fucking elliptical right now. Like, it's great.
Yeah. And I think sometimes too, we also discount how much people take some of what we say to heart. And it's really easy to understate that. And I think a lot of people who are, you know, especially much more from an academic background may very well not realize sometimes the impact that it has. And, you know, I think that's always something we got to be cognizant of too, which is why I think a softer approach and saying, hey, look, you know, if you're training for, you know, long distance hiking or something, spend more time on your feet if you can, but you know, don't dismiss a piece of equipment that has plenty of value to 99% of people.
Dude, that's such a good point, because there are times, like, you know me, I'm a jokester. Like, I like to crack jokes. I like to have fun. There have been times where I've cracked jokes on social media, like on Instagram, me thinking that it was very clearly a joke.
Yeah.
But then getting a lot of messages from people saying, like, oh my God, I didn't know that. And like, so I'll give you an example. So I love to do accents. Like, I like to do different accents and voices. Like, sometimes if my wife and I go out to eat, sometimes I'll pretend I'm from somewhere else to the waiter. And like, my wife gets pissed, but like, I think it's funny. I just do that. Like, I like to have fun with that. So sometimes I'll do Q&As in accents. And there was one specific segment, I used to do this all the time, where I would say, I'll answer your question in 5 words or less. And I would always use an accent with the answer. And someone asked me, they said, do your calories roll over? And I was answering in a Russian accent, and I was like, no, it doesn't roll over like your phone plan or something like that. Thinking it was just a joke. But, like, actually, you can think about calories sort of like rolling over to the following day or over the week. But I had spoken about that so much previously that I just assumed everyone knew I was joking. But I got a lot of people being like, wait, but I thought that you could count calories over the course of a week. And I was like, fuck, now I just made this joke that is confusing people with their nutrition. And so then I had to delete it and I had to make a clarification. And it was one of those things where I was like, man, I do have to be very careful with if I'm trying to be witty or even like whatever it is, because everything I say, people could take it one way or another way, and it can massively impact their lives. I really do. You're right. Like, I think it's very easy to underestimate the influence that you have, even if you don't even have a large audience. But if you have 7 people watching your stuff, like it's a ripple effect, and it can really, really impact people.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, we may speak about something and in our head have 10 different disclaimers thinking about the nuance, but then realize, of course, that, you know, here we are, we sit in this field for, you know, day in and day out. And, you know, somebody who is looking to communicators, because we all do this, we all look to different fields for communicators who can distill out what's important. We need that consistency with them. And again, that's why something as silly as the, you know, the elliptical and saying it's not a good piece of equipment. Look, I could list off bad, you know, reasons the elliptical sucks for hours, but that wouldn't make a difference because I still think it's a great piece of equipment. Mm. And, you know, I think it's got to be clear that that's the takeaway for most people before you start talking about the nuances. Like, leave the door open for nuance, but clarity and consistency in communication, and not intentionally or unintentionally gatekeeping something that a lot of people rely on as a you know, great alternative that works for them.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's super smart. Now, let me ask you this. What piece of equipment in the gym do you absolutely hate, if any? You can either choose a piece of equipment or an exercise that you see a lot of people doing. And you've got to provide the nuance to it. You got to provide the nuance. And you could say, like, this is the one I hate, but here are the positives, here are the negatives. Like, you can go all in the nuance. But I'm very interested, what is one piece of equipment or one exercise that you absolutely hate?
I would say I hate the BOSU ball.
Okay.
And that it's not because I necessarily think it's completely useless either.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are certain cases where there are certain exercises you can use the BOSU in quite a few ways. And I don't even need to get into that now, but I think it's one of those things that is absolutely overprescribed with all the wrong mindset.
Yes.
There's this thought like, you need to use it for an unstable surface, and instability training makes any lift, you know, inherently better. And it doesn't. Like, it just, people doing lifts on the BOSU just because instability is making it harder is all wrong. Like, neurologically doesn't make sense. As like, it just, from a biomechanics and, you know, it just, it's totally illogical, but people will do that. And I think when there's a piece of equipment that is misunderstood more often than it's actually used correctly, I inherently dislike it. Mm. And I think that's one of the biggest things, because I think it has very focused purposes, which I don't think we need to get into here, but I'm sure people will probably ask at some point. It has very focused purposes, but again, most of the stuff I'm seeing it's used for is counterproductive. So anytime I see it out, I tend to cringe a little bit.
Dude, and I, number one, I completely agree with you. You bring up another logical fallacy that I see a lot. Like, this is important. I want to emphasize these because it's so easy for someone to hear like, oh, it makes it more difficult because you have to balance, and then immediately think, oh, it makes it more difficult. Yeah. It's better. Yeah. Just because it makes it harder does not make it better. That's what she said. Just because it makes it more difficult does not mean it is a better exercise. It's and this is in everything in life. Just because something is more challenging, just because something is more difficult does not make it better. Just because something is more quote unquote natural does not make it better. These are all really important critical thinking skills to have to understand. What are they actually saying and what is it actually doing? Dude, I completely agree. I think the BOSU ball has many great potential uses. Yep. But when I walk into any gym in the world, the likelihood that it's being used for one of those great things is so outrageously minuscule. Like, I actually am a big fan of using the BOSU ball for push-ups, for like instability training in the shoulders. Like, it's great for that. For some people, if you can't do push-ups yet, then no, just do it on the fucking ground or hands elevated. You shouldn't be using unstable surface training if you can't do a push-up yet. But if I'm working with, maybe an overhead athlete, a baseball player, volleyball player, tennis player, in order to help get better activation of the rotator cuff, help increase shoulder stability, I think there are some great, great uses for that. You don't see many people doing a push-up on a BOSU ball and then getting hurt. You do see people trying to do squats on a BOSU ball and getting very hurt. And this isn't uncommon. There, dude, I don't know if you, I was an expert witness in a trial for a woman, a coach had this like 60s to 70 something year old woman squatting on a BOSU ball and throwing a fucking medicine ball at her. Catching it. She fell off. Tore ACL, MCL, PCL, like meniscus, everything. Multi-million dollar lawsuit that this like poor woman and poor like the coach didn't want anything bad to happen, but now the coach's life is fucked. The woman like is it hurt? She lost all functional use of her leg after that. And I was an expert witness in this trial because I wrote an article in 2012 about, you know, the myths and fallacies of unstable surface training, this being one of them. Like, you shouldn't have your client standing on a BOSU ball. And it even says on the BOSU ball package and website, do not stand on the flat side of the BOSU ball. But every time I post about it, I get coaches mad at me and a lot of physical therapists getting mad at me. And I'm like, listen, here's the deal. I understand if you want to train, have some unstable surface training, maybe for ankle stability and stuff like that. But you could also just, I mean, number one is just, can they even balance on one leg on the flat ground? Number one. Number two is, could you use an AirX pad that's an inch and a half off the ground and still get all of the same benefits, or get a sandbox? Stand in and like, there's so many things you can do as opposed to risking having that fall. So, yeah.
You know, cause I think that, like, and I think getting back to it also, and I think this is kind of like ties together. I think a lot of things we've been talking about, just because something is difficult doesn't mean it's better. Mm-hmm. Just because something challenges you doesn't even mean it's the challenge you need. And you know, I think that almost comes back to like the very first thing we talked about is that if something is hard, making it more difficult or thinking just because it's really difficult, does that mean it's giving you something you need? Think about what you're trying to get out of it. If you're squatting on a BOSU, what are you trying to develop? Are you trying to develop leg strength, or are you trying to develop balance? Or what is your objective here behind doing this exercise? The elliptical, if you're getting on it, are you on the elliptical because you want to become a faster runner, or are you on there for heart health? Like, you know, it's going, okay, so like, let's not try to think of things in terms of, you know, this is a challenge and therefore it needs to, let's think about what we want to get out of this challenge. In rising to this challenge, in adapting to this challenge, in adapting to this exercise, to this task, whatever else, the things we would need to do to get incrementally better at them, are those the things we want to get out of this endeavor? Is that process of improvement here, that progressive overload that's happening here, is that what we want?
I love that. Now I have to ask just the next logical question is, what is one exercise or piece of equipment that you love / you think is very underrated? Like, what do you think you would like to see more people doing in the gym?
That's a really, really good question too. I love belt squats.
Oh, yes, dude.
I love belt squats, whether it's an actual belt squat machine or like a squat belt or anything else. What a great way to get a lot of the benefits of squats. And that includes, you know, much more, you know, the ability to adjust your stance and move an external load, because, you know, leg press, I still like the leg press. I like hack squats and everything else, but I like the fact that, you know, a belt squat allows for like different pelvic configurations and stance widths and everything else. It is such a versatile movement. It is great, especially if you're dealing with any kind of back or shoulder issues or anything else. And the variants you can do on it, you can do Bulgarian split squats with a belt squat. It's fantastic. And
do you have a belt squat machine?
I have a belt squat setup. Okay. I actually just have a belt with a chain on it that I can use for belt squats. I would love to have a belt squat machine. That is kind of like on my short list of things I would love to get.
It's such a great machine, man. I remember when I was at Westside, I would use it all the time. I've never to this day had a glute pump like I did when I would use the belt squat machine without any stress on my back whatsoever. Yeah. Like the traction on the spine felt so good. Like, oh yeah, that is even, I remember Louis, rest in peace, he used to make me just march for 20 minutes, march in place on the belt squat machine. Yeah. It was the worst. It was the absolute worst.
That sounds horrible, man.
I love that machine. That's a really good one. And you don't see it in many gyms. It's a pretty big piece of equipment, and I would imagine it's pretty expensive. I haven't looked at it, but man, you don't see it in as many gyms as I'd like.
Yeah, but if anyone listening to this is either a gym owner or has an in with their gym owner and ever has the ability to give any input on what piece of equipment they should pick up next, I would say, you know, if your gym even like, if all you have is squat racks and you want to decide if you need to get a leg press next, I would say go for a belt squat first.
100%. Yeah, I completely agree. Dude, I was just thinking about some of the stuff that Louis would do and Louis had me do. Louis was big on, battle ropes, obviously. Yeah. But Louis, having to take everything to extreme, he loved using chains.
Chains, I can see.
Dude, he would use these like super heavy chain links, and man, this guy, I mean, he would be out there, I think they were like 20 pound, like the chains would be like 20 pounds, and he'd be out there for 30 minutes, just clink, 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 clink for 30 minutes. It was unbelievable. Really incredible.
Yeah. That's, I mean, that is also a pretty good conditioning workout.
Yeah.
it's not as functional or natural as running.
Yeah, yeah. I see what you did there.
We're cycling.
Dude, how is your training going right now for you personally? Like, what are you working on? What are you trying to develop right now? I mean, I think I just saw you pulled, was it 700? You deadlifted 700 for 3, was it?
That last one didn't quite make it.
It was close. It was almost, 700 for 2¾.
You know, right now I'm literally just training I'm leaning into whatever it is I enjoy.
Okay.
And so for about an 8-week period there, I was just loving getting off the trail and just doing some fast road runs. So I leaned into that, was having fun with some fast interval work. Right now, my biggest thing is I want to keep lifting the heaviest stuff I can lift without any kind of pain.
Mm.
And so, you know, this year, again, I would love to get out to the Grand Canyon sometime this year. Doing the rim to rim to rim is still something that, you know, that's definitely on the list. I haven't really enjoyed a lot of the super long distance stuff lately, so I'm just doing it.
Okay.
You know, I'm spending a lot of time just kind of working on speed and, you know, just kind of having fun out there and figuring out what's next. So also the way I see it is sometimes I know, and especially this is true for me, when people don't have a specific goal in mind, they tend to kind of not know what to do.
Mm.
And, you know, that's been something I've dealt with personally a lot. And not having a specific goal, my goal is just continue doing everything. And whenever something catches my attention, sink myself into it and just throw myself into it. And just keep doing that until a goal comes along, because, you know, I also realize if I just keep doing the stuff I don't want to do, I'm probably going to lose interest and it's going to suffer.
Mm.
And so not having a goal, my goal is to just lean into whatever it is I'm enjoying. And that way, if something does come along that I want to do, I can shift gears and get back into that.
I love that.
So that's really it. Deadlifting heavy and running.
Didn't you run? You ran a sub 6-minute mile the other day as well.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at right now.
What was it? It was five what?
It was like 5:42, I think, was the one on that.
I was so jealous. Like I was so jealous when I saw that you did that, and it just made me feel like such a wuss that I still can't break it. But like, yeah, man, it's you're such a savage.
It might. I mean, let's be honest. If you were actually able to, I think, get out on some of these trails, And you know, because I did it on the road out here, but there's something that lets me go so much faster out on the road.
Really?
It's oh yeah.
Why is that? Why could you go faster on the road than on a treadmill?
I think a big part of it is one of the reasons I have real trouble doing fast work on the treadmill is there's always this thought I'm devoting a certain amount of brain power to maintaining pace and staying on the belt. There's always in the back of my mind, there's this thought that there's a little element of coordination to it. And being out there on the road, worst case scenario, if you you're just going all out and you speed up, you slow down, you take a big step, you take a small step, whatever else, you know you're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. And I think that lets me put just like that 3% more energy into pushing it hard.
Interesting.
Yeah. So.
Interesting. Okay.
I don't know. Just a thought when it warms up. I say we try this again when you get the chance to maybe just, kind of haul ass down the boulevard.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, yeah, definitely will. I still feel like a wuss considering like you are like 100 pounds more than me and can still run a mile significantly faster than me. But it's okay.
I've also been at this a while. I mean, let's be honest.
Dude, you know what we might be able to do to like finish this call over the next few, like, I don't know, however long, is I know we want to catch up on my training. And so, yeah. Again, Alex is my coach. He writes my programs. If you like want to like wrap up with like doing a coaching call recorded so people can hear how that works, like,
yeah.
And I know I have not been consistent with some of the things you've been writing, and you even wrote my program, like, this is going to be the last like week where you like don't give me shit for not doing some of this stuff. So like, do not feel like you have to pull your punches. Like, okay. Like there's 100%. Well, and I'll be 100% honest as I always try to be. So like, we'll do the coaching call now too.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay, so
this is where, this is where I hand over the reins to lead.
Okay. All right. So first things first. I'm not even gonna narrate this. Basically, you're just gonna say, okay. So you've mentioned that obviously your rolling performance has been good now. Your conditioning has been great. Yeah. You told me a couple of even just stories about rolling with guys where your capacity has gone up. So that's excellent. On the conditioning side and the training, so you have been doing a lot of the low intensity work. How has that higher intensity work, a lot of the interval work and all that, how has that been going? Have you been hitting those sessions?
So I'll give you the breakdown. So, number one is my work capacity and conditioning in jiu-jitsu has been unbelievable. Like the best it's ever been. All of the people I've been rolling with have been tiring out significantly before me. It's been amazing. Like, I'm beyond happy with that. And it's actually allowed me to have more high quality training because I'm less tired. So I get more time to actually focus on the technique before I get exhausted. So that's been great. The zone two, as you've seen in my training logs, because my watch is connected to the app, like it's been, I've been crushing it. I've been doing more zone two than you've programmed. I've just been like going above and beyond. Like, that's been great. I have not done any high intensity work since I got sick over Thanksgiving. I got really sick, the most sick I've been in as long as I can remember over Thanksgiving. And it took me about probably like 3 weeks to really recover from it. So there have been about the last 3 weeks I've been okay. And health wise, I've been fine. And my conditioning recovered very, very quickly. But I was like, fuck it. I'm going to take the next few weeks off the high intensity stuff because, frankly, I'm just a little bitch and I was lazy with it. And like, I didn't want to do it. And it's my least favorite. Like, I really enjoy the lower intensity, longer duration stuff, which is funny because I never used to like that. But that's one of my favorite things to do now is this low intensity, long duration. I feel so good from doing it, man. Like, my sleep quality is better. My appetite is better. My performance is better. My mood is better from this longer duration, low intensity stuff. And it's so easy to get myself to do it now. Whereas the sprints, bro, I hate the sprints. Now, I didn't miss a single session that you ever programmed prior to this. Like, I hit every single one, Now I just need to get back into it. And I used being sick as the excuse. And then like the last 3 weeks, I was like, holidays, whatever. Now I'm going to get back into it. But for the last 3 weeks, I have not, or the last 6 weeks, I have not done any of the high intensity stuff.
Well, and I think it's difficult, but also what this shows, and I think a lot of people probably wonder about this, is how well do you maintain your fitness if you just do the low intensity stuff? And the answer is you maintain it pretty damn well.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing, so what I typically do is, you know, in a case like this, so getting back into the high intensity work, I'll probably have to lower the intensity, the specific intensity of a lot of these, but can maintain the pretty much the same structure. The only thing that's really going to suffer, you're going to notice, is that your top end sustained, like your, you know, VO2 max lactate threshold is going to suffer a little bit, but it'll come back really quickly. So there are, you know, basically two options to kind of get you back up to peak performance. Because what I would like to do is be able to hammer your high intensity work for like 3 weeks. Because that'll get you back probably 75 to 80% of your high intensity capacity very quickly.
Okay.
And it's not going to be fun, but it's going to get it back. And at that point, we literally just stick with kind of the minimum effective dose of high intensity work. Because I think at this point, your high intensity capacity is everything you need it to be to succeed. You know, getting, you know, being able to improve your, you know, 30-second power output on cycling is probably not nearly as important as, you know, just overall general aerobic conditioning. So what we can do, what I would propose then, is a three-week period of quickly ramping you back up to your high-intensity proficiency, which isn't going to be that much more volume than you've ever done. But then we can literally back off to 1 to 2 sessions per week, one of which will probably just be a sprint session, but like not a 2 minute sprint session, which is the absolute vomitous, like, please God, let me die. Because 30 seconds into it, you think you're almost done and you look down and you're like,
it's
quarter of the way done. Yeah. So it'll be, we're talking like 10, 15 second high intensity intervals, probably in a medley type of environment. And then the other will be one tempo type session,
cool,
you know, relatively brief. And I think what that'll let us do is, you know, again, like, there's not a specific objective. What you would have to do to get significantly faster at some of these high intensity sessions, it's not going to make you better at your sport. You don't like it. Let's not make you do it just because it's a challenge.
Yeah.
So let's get you just what you need, I think, to get back to your peak level of performance. And then we'll just kind of put that in kind of a maintenance and do just enough that you're not losing any ground on the high intensity, but still making plenty of gains in the overall aerobic capacity.
Perfect. Yeah. Makes total sense.
Yeah. I mean, because I guess the other thing is, how important is it to you to actually break that, you know, your current mile PR?
That's important. That is like, that's a real goal that I have that, like, at first it wasn't. At first I didn't care. But now that I've failed multiple times, now I care. Now it's like, all right, like this, I have to accomplish this. Like, this is just a mental thing that I really want to do. Like, I want a sub 550. I want a sub 542 just so I can beat you.
I think so. Let me put it this way though. Like, the whole conversation we've just had about like making sure that what you're pushing for here is what you really want, you know, cause it's going to involve doing things you don't want to do.
Oh yeah. And I'm okay. You know me, like, okay. I'm totally fine with that. It's funny. My buddy Mike would laugh. I'm like very competitive and like uselessly competitive. Like, it doesn't make sense, the things I get competitive over, but like, this is how I deadlifted 4 times my body weight. This is how I've done so much of this stuff. It's like, listen, once I want to do it, I want to do it. And I know it's not going to be like necessary for my jiu-jitsu, but this is something I want to do. Like, I really want to do it and I know I can, I just have to fucking do it. So yeah, absolutely. Let's make it happen.
All right. Yeah. So as far as the conditioning side, that'll be kind of the priority. So we'll use this 3 weeks, like I said, to get it back up. We'll have all your higher intensity work kind of serve the dual purpose of, I mean, improving your mile time. That'll just be its own objective. And I think in the process of doing that, obviously your conditioning is only going to get better.
Yeah. Yeah. So that makes total sense.
Cool. Yep. And the other thing I want to talk about is putting in again, some of the breath work and the breath hold work. Cause I know we've gotten away from that for a little bit.
Yeah. Yep.
Going to put that in again, not necessarily because I think you need to make even greater improvements on it. Like, I don't think holding your breath for 6 minutes is going to improve your performance anywhere else. But I think a lot of it actually is just a good set of drills to put in every couple months just to kind of, again, reinforce the fact that, you know, this oxygen need, the panic urge to breathe, we can dissociate the needing to breathe from the panic reflex. Mm. And just, again, just kind of engage in those drills that are meant to make breath hold work and a lack of air be something you can still process in a relaxed state, rather than going all, you know, hyper aroused and terrified when you feel like you can't get a breath in. So we're going to be putting that in for a couple of weeks just to reinforce it.
You know, it's so funny. Like when I first saw you putting these breath holds in early on, like a year ago, I didn't understand it. And now it's pretty crazy, because I've been put in really bad situations when I'm training jiu-jitsu, like where, you know, I'm getting choked out or I'm getting like literally suffocated. I can't breathe. Someone's like lying on top of me. And I would say within the last 6 months, I've gotten to a point where I can be in a very dangerous situation and be very calm in my head and have real thoughts of strategy, of talking to myself, calming myself down. These are things where, and the main, like, I love jiu-jitsu for many reasons, and I love the sport of jiu-jitsu, and I love competing. But the main reason is I want to be able to defend myself if, God forbid, I ever need to. Yeah. And I look at a lot of videos online of people being attacked and having these massive panic responses. And obviously it's easier to armchair expert and look online and to, if I'm not actually in that situation. But I really, really think that number one, doing jiu-jitsu, number two, doing these breath holds has allowed me to be in very high stress situations, but calm. And to be able to think and not give up out of nowhere or have like an instinctual response that puts me in an even worse position. Exactly. It's been very cool to notice how like I could hold my breath for 24 seconds longer than I thought I could, as long as I just calm down, close my eyes, and I can just sort of think about like relax my way through it, as opposed to try and grip my way through it.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's what's been so important about this, is just even showing that what is what previously used to be a panic response is now something where you can actually, obviously not take a deep breath, but you can step back for a minute and think rationally about something that used to be very instinctive and not necessarily for the better.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's such a good skill anywhere in life, but I think especially in a sport where there's somebody just putting pressure on you, trying to get you to make a mistake.
Yeah. And
if they put you in a position where they think he's going to panic, and you don't, you've just removed that chess move they just made is going to fail.
Oh, dude, 100%. It's been so interesting with jiu-jitsu, because sometimes people will put you in positions in which, so they're trying to choke you out or whatever it is. And in order to do that, they're using a lot of strength and isometric strength to try and get you to squeeze on, whether it's an arm bar, choking out, whatever it is. Yeah. And sometimes you're in such a position, like you just can't get out. You just got to try and wait it out, if you can. And for me, I've been in these positions where I'm like, I am so uncomfortable right now. Like I'm in a very uncomfortable situation, but I'm going to wait, because I know for a fact that I can outlast their isometric squeeze. And I'm just going to wait. And then when they're done and they have to let go because they just can't squeeze anymore and they're exhausted, now I'm going to go on the offensive.
Yeah,
and it's, exactly. Dude, it has been an unbelievable like revelation and huge change in my game to really just sort of let the other person tire them out and get really frustrated when they're trying to put me in uncomfortable situations and I can withstand that uncomfortable situation. It's very cool.
Yeah, no, that's excellent, man. And that's been a huge part of the focus. And, you know, your breath hold has gone up tremendously. And just, you know, again, that combined with the conditioning is, I think, part of what makes you such a tough nut to crack for anybody.
Yeah,
that's what you want.
I want to check really quick, because it looks like my I think my resting heart rate has went down significantly, and I wanted to show it to you. My resting heart rate, dude, check this out. So my resting heart rate has been, I don't know if you, fuck, it's 40 beats per minute.
40. Like, excellent.
Talk to me about that. Is that like, is that good? Is that, it doesn't matter? Like, what do you think about that number?
Yeah. So that's actually a really good question, because I think a lot of people want to know, like, what's a good resting heart rate? 40 is kind of pretty much about the lower limit of what you can get through structural improvements in your heart. Because over time, you know, again, it's not just that your heart muscle gets stronger, it's that your heart actually, like, the stroke volume goes up. You pull in more blood when it expands, and your ejection fraction, in other words, the amount of blood that you're pumping out on every pump, goes up. So you're basically, your heart is just moving about as efficiently as it is as possible. People who are less fit, like, their heart is just not, it's not pumping out all the blood, it's not expanding as much, it's working too hard to go against back pressure, you know, whatever that happens to be. 40 is pretty much about what you'll see as far as the best adaptations can go. When you see people with less than 40, usually that's a sign of, you know, sinus bradycardia. That's the heart itself, just based on autonomic nervous system input, is just almost artificially low. And that's to allow, it just has to do with the way the autonomic nervous system responds to stress and everything else. But yeah, a 40 resting heart rate, that's phenomenal. And it means that as far as stroke volume goes, ejection fraction, vascular elasticity, all these other things that are really measurements of how efficient your cardiovascular system is, that's about as good as you can get.
That's awesome. Is the resting heart rate, is that something you would look at in terms of as a marker of health in an individual? Is that something you look at, or is that not as important as you would say, like, blood pressure?
Yeah, blood pressure is far more important, obviously. But provided that's under control, yeah. I mean, you know, is assuming that the individual is otherwise, you know, anything else, medications can affect it. Are you taking beta blockers? Are you taking this, that, or the other? But for an otherwise healthy individual, seeing a steady downward trend in it and then seeing them maintain that in conjunction with a good lifestyle, it's absolutely a good thing. And again, it means that because it's coming down as a result of the exercise you've been doing, all the steps you've been taking is making your heart more efficient. It's making it pump better. It's probably pumping against less back pressure, all these other things. So as a good, you know, variable that takes into account 30 different things, it's absolutely something I look at.
Got it.
And so, yeah. So, yeah, and that's great. That's phenomenal.
Awesome. Well, listen, yeah. Alex, I love you, man. Could you tell people where they can follow you, where they can sign up for coaching, where whatever they can do with you? I mean, I just can't sing your praises highly enough.
No, man. Yeah, like, I'm on Instagram, alex.viata. My company is at Complete Human Performance, one word. Those are the best places to find our stuff. I do Instagram Q&As, Complete Human Performance. You can always DM them for any questions on coaching or anything else. We got a lot of content up there. So that's the best portal, and that'll also get you over to our website and all of that kind of stuff. So that's the best place for it.
And I'll say, I mean, Alex is not paying me for this, number one. I've been a paying client of yours. I pay full price, a paying client of yours, for over a year now. And I've been just unbelievably impressed. And I have friends and colleagues who are also in your program who absolutely love it. Huge, huge, huge fan, and a forever, forever fan of what you do. And so if you've been thinking about signing up with Alex, definitely strongly recommend it. If you have not been thinking about it and you don't know who he is, go check out his Instagram and stuff. Just, I've been a big fan for years, and I always appreciate you and look up to you. So thank you so much, man.
Jordan, man, thanks for being one of the good guys in the business. And conversations like this just reinforced how happy I am to have you in my circle. So thank you, man.
Likewise, man. That wraps it up for this episode of the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes or Spotify. They really help the podcast a lot. So huge thank you to everyone who's done that already. And if you'd like to join the Inner Circle, you can do that at www.sfinnercircle.com, or just go to the link in the show notes. Have a wonderful day, and I'll talk to you soon.